you live in majority white Cullman County.
Correct.
You've served in office there and on boards.
Mm-hmm.
You were the first African-American to run for a legislative seat in Cullman County.
Correct.
At the time, Democrats urged you to withdraw, but you didn't.
No.
Why not?
There was a deep urge or something deep inside kept saying, you know, there were people who wanted me to run and they felt like that I would be the best leader for them because we identified with one another. We trusted one another. And there was no way that I could withdraw. It was like the old regime saying to you, you need to wait your time or we will select you for something else. But for this position, we need this person. This is the one we're supporting. I never forget the statement. If we took a poll of the people that was in the room when you announced that you were running, probably 80% of those people in that room would vote for you. But James, remember, you're in Cullman, and you won't win. And I said, well, maybe we won't. But it's like saving the life of 100 children at the same time. You may not can save them all, but you can at least try, and you may save one or two. And that's worthwhile. And so I, in return, said to the gentleman that asked me to do that, I said, we're in the race. We would appreciate your support. And I don't know if he ever supported me. I know he voted for me when I met my Republican opponent.
This was the gentleman who asked you to withdraw.
Right. And I never will forget, if you could go back in the archives, you will see him embracing me on the front page of Cullman Times because he was just that shocked. And he has been one of my biggest supporters from that point on out. And even today, he often calls and says, James, you know, we're behind you. Just keep going. Keep going. You made a believer out of me once, and you'll make a believer out of me again. And so that's why we are in this race, because Alabama is stuck in neutral. She's running on life support as far as leadership is concerned, and she's looking for great leadership, and she wants to move forward. Alabama is a state of inclusiveness, and we have painted this picture for so long that we need to do something different. And without change, nothing changes.
You decided to run for political office shortly before President Barack Obama was inaugurated.
Correct.
In 2008.
Correct.
Thinking back on that time, what specifically was it that compelled you to jump into the political arena?
The need for leadership, the need for someone who had commitment and compassion for everybody. And serving in the United Methodist Church as a clergy, as a delegate to General Conference and working with the General Church and the World Methodist Church, I saw a lot of different things as traveling all over the world doing ecumenical type ministries. And if not me, then who?
So a more recent example of someone, a Democrat, who mm-hmm. has found success mm-hmm. here in Alabama is Democratic U.S. Senator Doug Jones.
Correct.
He had the difficult task of trying to appeal to progressive white voters mm-hmm. while also being attentive to the needs of the black community.
Correct.
Were there any lessons you took from that campaign on what to do or what not to do as you make your run for governor?
No, I think Doug Jones, U.S. Senator Doug Jones, did all the correct things. I remember on the campaign trail with him, and we were speaking in Tuscaloosa to energize the folks there. There were progressive, there was Republicans, there were Democrats, there were libertarians, there were independent voters. And I remember speaking to them and trying to make the analogy that you have right now between the two the best selection sitting among you, and that's Senator Doug Jones, at that time Mr. Doug Jones. And I remember, as you heard me coming down the hallway, saying to them, when you go to bed tonight, just repeat this word, Doug Jones. And when you get up in the morning, Doug Jones, because he is the right choice. And people erupted with hand claps because it touched them with the compassion that we believe that this young man, Doug Jones, will make the best U.S. Senator for Alabama at this juncture.
Let's talk for a minute about your childhood. Your father was a coal miner.
Correct.
Your mother worked at a chicken processing plant.
Mm-hmm.
Your father struggled with alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
How did you deal with that, and how would you say that might have shaped you today?
It was a struggle in our lives. There were, along with me, three other brothers and one little sister in the house. And for our first formative years, I'd say from zero to about seven, you know, we lived okay. You know, Dad worked in the mines, and we always had. And after the mines shut down, he went from this job to that job, working construction. And then later, he joined my mother at the poultry processing plant. But still, you know, a manhood in that era really meant something. You had to provide for your family. And Dad struggled with that. And we struggled with it because on the weekend, he would drink a whole lot, and he would come home and physically abuse our mother. And till we got larger, then we were able to stop him. And Dad would always realize that he was wrong. I can see him now with tears in his eyes late at night, apologizing to all of us and to our mother because we had no vehicle at that time. I remember it in my early years, our father always had at least two vehicles. He just, people loved him. He had that personality when he was not drinking that you loved him. And he was a man of great wisdom. He would always tell us, the boys, you know, you go out there in the field and you plow the mule, the ones of us that could plow, which was the older ones, and you help Uncle so-and-so and you help Aunt so-and-so, and said, if you keep living, one day this will pay off for you. I know I'm not the father that all of you wanted me to be, but we'll just keep going. And I could remember the last 5 years of his life. He rededicated his life to God, and he was a great soloist. And he used to stand up in that choir, and he would sing some of those old songs, some of those old Negro spirituals, and the women in the church would just cry and shout. And he became a father those last 5 years. In the last year of his life, he struggled with cancer because he had the black lungs and he smoked a lot. But I remember one night sitting there with him because my job allowed me a lot of leisure time. And I thought he had died because there was no sound. Mother had gone somewhere. And I went back there. And I shook him, and he said, Junior, I'm okay, because I'm named for his namesake. Mm-hmm. He said, Junior, I'm okay. You know, I love y'all. And we took him to the hospital on a Tuesday, on a Monday. We visited that with him that Monday and that Tuesday. We visited with him on that Wednesday. No one went to the hospital on Thursday. And early Friday morning, we got a phone call that he had died. And we all went up to the hospital. And it's amazing. Here was a man, 6'2", good-looking guy, who had dwindled down to about like 98 pounds. But that particular morning when we walked in that room, he looked like he weighed 160 or 70 pounds. His face was full. The smile was on his face. And we knew that our father was okay. But it was tough coming up as a child. It was tough.
Let's talk a little bit about education. You have talked a lot about the disparity among Alabama schools, where you have some schools with a tremendous amount of resources and other schools that are struggling just to keep up with basic needs. How do you propose to close that gap?
We got to first look at, number one, the disparity in funding through the ETF, the Education Trust Fund. And we must make sure that every area, what's going to have to happen is we're going to have to sit down with each school system. You got 67 counties and probably 130 plus school systems. You know, this city has their own school system. This city has all the population is moving north. And so what we're leaving behind are the poor, the downtrodden, the underemployed in the Black Belt area, in the South Alabama area, and in some of the other parts of the state, the western part, eastern part, and just different areas. It's true that some systems cannot, you know, what a meal tax in one area is different from what a meal tax is in another area.
Right, because it's based on property values.
It's based on property tax. So we got to look at our property tax and how we disperse those funds. And some school systems are going to have to make some tough decisions. You know, schools were built 100 years ago in particular communities, and they were community schools, and rightfully so. And people are attached to those schools. That's where I attended. That's where my mother attended, my grandmother attended. But now with our road system and accessibility, we're going to have to do some combining. I remember one superintendent of education had to make a tough decision on closing a couple of schools. And they fought through it, and people got over it. And so that's some of the things we'll have to look at in order to make sure that each classroom have the funding that they need. A lot of my opponents on both sides are especially on the Democrat side, talking about an education lottery or naming it some fancy name. The lottery, even if you get it before the people to vote on, it's still going to be 2 years down the road. We still haven't done anything for those children for 2 years. But it may or may not pass. So you got to have a plan to make sure that these systems are funded.
So if I understand you right, you're not saying that you are opposed to an education lottery, but you're saying, look at where we are.
Right.
It's not guaranteed voters
Correct.
Are going to approve this. We need to think of an alternate plan.
We got to think of an alternative plan, and we got to make some hard decisions. Alabama has got to step forward. We're not a poor state. And we're not as bad as people say that we are, or so far behind in education, 46, 47. Our children are doing well. When I go throughout the state, even in the worst circumstances, the teachers are doing their best to make sure that the students are getting everything that they need to be productive and accomplish the goals that they're seeking. But we got to give them the twos.
Well, with all due respect, Mr. Fields, I think there are many people who would argue that educational achievement is a real challenge in some parts of the state.
That's because we're not properly funding them. And it's like who the person with the gold rules. So we got to make sure that that gold is spread around.
Right.
And G-O-L-D.
So if not a lottery, what would be a good way to do that?
We got to look at property tax. Everybody's got to pay their fair share in taxes. And we can't continue to go down this road denying the fact that we have the lowest property taxes in the country. Even if we doubled our property tax, we'll still be the lowest in the country. This is not a tax and spend issue. This is about a human issue. This is about taking care of our children and their children and generations to come. Now, if we want to move everybody to North Alabama, you're still going to have the same problem. You're just going to have all that property laying there. You know, I'm one, you know, we need to keep our pristine properties. We need our lumber areas, our timber areas. We need our hunting area forever a while. We need to keep funding things like that so that people be able to take their children to hunting, to fishing, to teach them about outdoors. But there are people in those areas who need to be taken care of. And we are our brother's keeper, whether we want to admit it or not. We have got to make some tough decisions. And a good administrator, a good governor, a good chief executive will surround him or herself with people with the knowledge to go in there and look at how we are structured based on our taxes and make sure that these classrooms have funds and make sure that our teachers are well paid.
So possibly an increase in property tax to help.
Possibly.
Close that gap.
Yes, possibly. Online shopping now. We're not getting taxes off of that. And we got to put a stop to that. We got to tie that loophole up.
Well, the state is.
Yeah.
The state now has the collects sales taxes through online sales, but we've only started recently doing that.
Correct.
We missed out on a lot of years.
We missed out on a lot of years, and we're missing still out on a lot of things that we could be doing. It breaks your heart when you hear people say, well, I'm conservative, I'm a Christian conservative, I'm an ultra-conservative. You can't boast about that when your brother is over here starving and they don't have anything.
So that's a good place for us to move onto religion.
Correct.
You are a Methodist minister, and people might wonder how you view your role, how you view the role of religion in state government. What would you say to people who want a clear line of separation between church and state?
Through my experience working with the World Methodist Church and dealing with ecumenical dialogues, you cannot force religion on anyone. And that will never be my role to say, well, you guys over here, it would be like a Jonah experience. I'm not going to go down to Nineveh because if I go down there, God's going to save them. So I'm going to go somewhere else. That's not our role. As clergy, all we do is share the good news. And the good news is that you're going to have a leader who understands the role of clergy, the role of church, the role of state, the role of laity. And we understand the rule of law. And Alabama and any state, even the scripture teaches you that we are subject to the law. Whatever the law of the land is, we got to support it with the understanding that this is where we stand and on our moral issues or on our faith issues. If everybody was United Methodist, we would be probably messed up. If everybody looked the same, even though God said, let us make man in our image, what God was saying is let us shape man in an image to where he or she represents us in spreading the good news. And so church has its role, state government has its role, and you got to have someone who is able to bridge the gap and to hold on to both sides and bring them along. And so, I hope that people won't be sitting around saying, well, he's going to hang a monument up here and a monument up there. No, I'm going to make sure that families are made whole.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, just to take this around to an example facing voters. In November, there's going to be an amendment on the ballot asking voters whether they want to allow the Ten Commandments to be displayed in schools and government offices. So where do you stand on that?
Again, if the legislative body or if the people of Alabama vote, then we got to uphold the law. This is simple. We are governed by laws.
Right. But are you in favor of this even going on the ballot as an amendment before voters to decide? Should this even be something that Alabama voters consider?
Then I would ask Alabama voters, do you have them sitting in your house? Do you have them, when you build your home, do you put the Ten Commandments up on the wall of your home? People got to remember that when the Ten Commandments was written in stone and when Moses came off the mountaintop, after viewing what was going on, what did he do with the Ten Commandments? He threw them down and broke them. God is not so much concerned with you displaying a cross on your arm or your body or the Ten Commandments tattooed to your forehead. God is more concerned with what's on your heart. If people in Alabama truly believe in the Ten Commandments, and I believe they do because they're fighting for it, if we follow the Ten Commandments, we've already shown that you can't keep the law. That's why Jesus Christ came, because we couldn't keep the law. And so he found a more better and excellent way. It is by grace that we're saved through faith, not of works. And so we need to settle that issue. If it's on the ballot and the people of Alabama vote that it should be displayed in public places and schools, then that's what we will do. But we got to be very careful that we got to understand what the Ten Commandments mean. And it's a tough road. And they were broken over and over. Every time God would send a prophet, they would break the Ten Commandments.
So here, I'll turn your mic down. Just to be sure that I'm hearing you right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You are not necessarily opposed to the display of the public of the Ten Commandments in public spaces if the voters want that.
No.
But it's not something that you would go to advocate for on your own.
No, it's not something I'm going to be out there jumping up and down on the stomp saying, hey, we're going to have the Ten Commandments. We need to take care of our brothers. We need to take care of our sisters. We need to take care of our children. And we can't feed them stone. And so, again, if the people of Alabama vote for the Ten Commandments to be displayed, we're going to support that with every fiber of our being. But let's not forget what the issue is. The issue is that family matters, and we must make families whole. We must make sure that people are gainfully employed. We must make sure that mom and dad are able to put food on the table. We must be concerned with the well-being of our children. We must be concerned that they're healthy. We must be concerned that health care should be provided to everybody. We don't need to be fighting over something that God has already settled.
Okay. And that brings us to something else I wanted to talk about with you. Let's talk about employment mm-hmm. and economic development.
Mm-hmm.
You have said that you want Alabamians to be able to work for a livable wage.
Mm-hmm.
What is a livable wage to you, and what do you see as some of the biggest obstacles to increasing wages here?
Probably the biggest obstacle is that we have approached this thing in such a way that we want to keep a certain segment of our population at a certain level. Everybody's not going to own two trucks, two boats, three cars, a home on the beach, and a home wherever their base home is. But everyone should be able to take their children on a vacation. Everyone should be able to provide the things that other children have for their children. And a livable wage will be determined based on this employer's revenue. When I say that, if you are a steel worker, there's a category. If you are a coal miner, there's a category. If you're working in the poultry industry, there's a category. Again, when my mother worked in the poultry industry and my father later worked in the poultry industry, they made a nickel more per the minimum wage per hour, $2.35, they were making $2.40, then $2.45, and then $2.50 an hour. That was big money in the 60s and early 70s. That was a lot of money. But it wasn't until organized labor came by and says, hey, look, you know, these families are working hard every day. They're hanging live poetry and they're in the worst conditions. The women, hands are cold, their feet are wet. They need aprons to keep their bodies from getting soaking wet from the waters flying all around. And they need to be able to do that. And I can remember my mother had worked there for certain years, and each year or every 5 years, you would earn another week's vacation. Now, they had the option when their vacation time came about, they could either take their vacation for 3 weeks or they can keep working, and then they would get three checks as if they were working 40-hour-a-week checks. And they would take their three checks to make sure that we had a nice 4th of July. We were able to cook out around the house, a pair of tennis shoes, two pair of shorts, and some T-shirts to wear. But they would keep working because we still needed the money to pay the utilities and et cetera and buy groceries. And so families should not have to go through that. You should be able to take a week off from work and spend time with your children.
So what is keeping people from having that now?
I don't know. With the exception of there's no one fighting for them. You still got organized labor who is fighting with every ounce of energy they have. People in poultry industry now are making fairly good wages. $12-$13 an hour, and that's really good for poultry industry to be paying that because we eat a lot of chicken. And so they're working very hard to make sure that those employers are treated fairly. Alabama is a right-to-work state, but employers still have a responsibility. They must keep documentation. You know, yeah, they can walk in and say, you know, we don't need you anymore. Well, why? Did they come to work wearing a green shirt instead of a blue shirt? Had you warned them before about their character or their demeanor or their clothing? So employers got to be held to accountability as well. And I think it's good when people can sit down at a table and bargain. When they can sit down at a table and everybody come to a happy conclusion saying, this is what's fair.
Do you think that Alabama is doing all that it can right now to both attract top talent from elsewhere and hold on to its brightest?
We're losing our brightest because, you know, Amazon wanted to come to Alabama. They had their eyes on Alabama. But we're lacking in broadband, and we're lacking in infrastructure, which broadband is a major piece of that. People want to be able to communicate. You know, a lot of people work from home now with their computers and stuff. Well, there are certain parts of Alabama you don't even have broadband, and people have to drive another mile down the road just to get cell phone usage because of the towers and the way they're situated and the beautiful rolling hills of Alabama. So we got to do that in order to keep our children when they finish college here. You know, it's amazing. We are graduating engineers, top engineers, lawyers, doctors, nurses. Alabama probably produced more nurses than anybody in the country because we got some great nursing schools, UAB, Wallace Community College, and other community colleges throughout the state have nursing programs, and we're putting them out there, and they are some of the best in the world. But some are having to work weekends in other states just to get gainful and good employment, and some of our engineers are leaving here. So what we can do in Alabama is just a vision, and we can do it, because without a vision, we're going to perish. Maybe a way of I mentioned one time about a commuter rail. And a couple of guys came up to me after my speech and said, you know, I've heard you speak a lot, but when you mentioned commuter rail, that is possible because we work for the railroad. My son just graduated as an engineer, and he had to move to Kentucky or somewhere to get a job. Mm-hmm. And he could have been working right here in Alabama. And so we got to think outside the box to keep our people here, our children here, and let them become entrepreneurs. Alabama is doing a lot to recruit industry. We are the third largest automobile producing state in the country. Michigan, South Carolina, Alabama. So we're not broke and we're not poor. And they're wanting to come to Alabama for one specific reason. We still have great work ethics in Alabama. People in Alabama will work. We just got to provide good, decent jobs, paying fair and equitable wages, and we got to make sure that health care is provided for our people, because if we're not healthy, we can't work. If we're not healthy, our children can't learn. And so we got to do something about that. And we got to close this issue on Medicaid expansion. We got to make sure that everybody in Alabama have access to good, affordable health care, and that they have a place that they can go to receive good health care.
Okay, good. And that's all. Health care is the last issue I'd like to talk about briefly with you. You say all Alabamians should have access to quality health care that they can afford. You are in favor of expanding Medicaid?
Yes.
And for the gap that won't be paid for by federal dollars that the state will have to pay, how do you propose paying for that at the state level?
Well, your revenue is going to be there, because by not expanding it, we've lost probably 30,000. This number has been thrown out there 100 times, 30,000 plus jobs. Lives are lost. Infant mortality is up. Hospitals are closing. We've lost probably $1.8 billion in revenue. That's how you're going to pay for it. Because right now we are providing 70% of the cost in Medicaid. Alabama's already doing that. Now, with the Medicaid expansion, it's reduced year all the way down to 3 years. And then we got to come up with at least half of that. Mm-hmm. So it's a 50-50 proposition. But look what we've just did. We put 30,000 people back to work, revenue. We've reopened some medical facilities. Maybe not all the hospitals, but we can open up some medical facilities in these areas. It may be a 50-bed unit to where we could get them there and then transfer them to a major hospital later on. We can do those things. But your revenue is again, will be generated. How did we find $3 million all of a sudden when the sitting governor came into office that she boasted she only had 3 hours to prepare for, and found $3 million right off the bat to motivate people to go out and look for work? You got career centers everywhere. We got to look at how we're duplicating services in Alabama. There's a lot of duplication of services. And so we got to, a good administrator, a good executive office will come in and will coalesce a team of good minds and says, look, we have got to cut out the waste. And once we cut the waste out, your money is going to be there. We know why Medicaid expansion was not signed. There were governors in other states, Republican governors, who signed on to the Medicaid expansion. There were governors in other states who was pushing the affordable health care. It wasn't until it received the name of Obamacare that everybody went, oop.
That's why it wasn't adopted here, you're saying?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And that's the sad part about it. Infant mortality rate went up. Older people could not get their medicine. That's inhumane. To think that we are in a civilized country, the best state in the country, and yet we refuse to provide health care to these people. Yet we refuse to make sure that they have access to good health care. We didn't sit back and say, okay, let us come up with a plan. We just don't want this. But we had no alternative. We didn't bring a plan to the table saying we can do this to make sure that our citizens in Alabama will be well taken care of. And no one on the opposing party is not even talking about the number of healthcare facilities that have been closed. No one on the opposing party has even talked about the infant mortality rate, but they'll talk about education, but they won't go to the heart of the problem. And the problem is that we are not paying close attention and we're not being compassionate and we're not funding and we can fund. Alabama is not broke. We just got to put the money where it should be. And that's the thing about the education lottery. We got to make sure if a education lottery bill is put before the people, that they understand this money will never take the place of the education trust fund.
You want it to work in conjunction with the education budget.
Because it's not going to make $300 million a year. It's not going to generate $300 million
a year. The lottery, you mean?
Yes. It will not generate that much money. It will generate a lot of money, but it's not going to generate that much. We got to make sure that there are funds set aside for addiction. People can get addicted to buying lottery. We got to make sure funds are set there. We got to make sure funds are set aside to make sure that every classroom, if it's passed, will have the adequate supplies they need. You know, I'm not going to give one school system, they got all they need, all the money they need, and then yet, they're going to say, well, why aren't we getting it? Well, what about that little school down there in Wilcox County? What about that little school down there in Dallas County? What about that little school in Sumter and Marengo County? You know, they've suffered long enough. They need some air conditioners put in their school so the kids can stay cool once it gets warm. They need some heating units, and they need good drinking water. There are areas where people can't even drink the water, and yet my opponents are not dealing with that. Chemical waste in certain areas where people are having to breathe this stuff and they're dying. They're not addressing that issue. So we cannot say we're going to do one thing on one side and forget that we're leaving out a whole piece that we must provide for the citizens of Alabama. And that's why we're running for the office, because somebody has got to put their foot down and make the hard decisions and look at lobbyists, these big PACs, and say to them, enough's enough. You know, I'm going to fight for that little old lady who sits at the end of that power line that we provide power to through our co-ops throughout the state. I'm going to fight for that family who sits at the end of that water line where you stopped it a mile from their house, and they have to get up every day with milk jugs to go get drinking water and walk back home. I did that in the 60s, mm-hmm. and we need to put a stop to that.
Mr. Fields, thank you so much for talking with me.